asked me to say a few words this morning, this afternoon. Actually, I volunteered to say them. About a year ago, our still relatively new provost spoke to us in this room about obstacles and opportunities at Stony Brook and laid out for us a number of problems and things that we ought to be doing to address them. I don't have to tell you that of all the people present in this room listening at that time, no one put forth more energy, more time, and more imagination in addressing those issues than Jerry himself. This is not the time to wrap up, to summarize, and to describe in great detail all the services that Jerry has performed for this institution. We'll have other occasions. But I do want to extend my personal appreciation to Jerry for the sacrifices that he's made to advance our institution. Last year, I was able to tell you something about Jerry's background, research interests, what he did before he was provost. This year, I don't have to say as much, because his actions speak more loudly than anything that has been recorded about his career. So without further introduction, I would like to ask our provost to come and tell us about obstacles and opportunities in Stony Brook, and to thank him as he comes to the podium for his service. Jerry?
Wondering, I would like to make one thing clear before I start. I was not fired, but it wasn't made heard. I resigned because of illness and fatigue. The president was sick and tired of me. My topic today is Stony Brook, Obstacles and Opportunities, a Progress Report. And it's a report, as the president has said, on how well we've done over the last year or so. Obstacles and opportunities have to be defined in the context of what you want to achieve, what you want to accomplish, where you want to go. Our goal is to establish Stony Brook as one of the premier research universities in the world, one of the top 10. There's no question about that. You can't lose sight, however, of the context within which we operate, the special situation. Because if we ever lose sight of that, we surely will fail to reach our goal. We are a research university, no question about it, but we're a very special kind of research university. We're a public research university. We're part of the SUNY system. That in itself is a challenge at times. We are on Long Island. We're not a private university with independence, and we're not the flagship campus of the State University of New York. There is no such designation. Last year, I pointed out that two of the factors that limit our growth don't have anything whatsoever to do with research. They are the quality, real and perceived, of our undergraduate enterprise and the size of the total enterprise at Stony Brook. Obstacles remain in both of those areas, but there are some encouraging signs. Let's look first at the quality, which I believe is the real quality of Stony Brook. The reality is good news. Stony Brook has the richest array of undergraduate programs and graduate programs on Long Island. We certainly have the most distinguished faculty. On a value-added basis, Stony Brook's record in undergraduate education is outstanding. Nearly half of Stony Brook's graduates go directly to graduate or professional school. Over 80% of those who apply to law school are admitted. Over 70% who apply to medical school are admitted. nearly 100%, actually 98%, who apply to dental school are admitted. An article in a recent issue of Change magazine ranked Stony Brook as 65th in the nation in terms of the productivity of PhDs based upon how many of our baccalaureate students went on to get PhDs. That's remarkable, because their analysis was for PhDs awarded between 1951 and 1980, and it was based upon students who received bachelor's degrees between 46 and 76. We didn't even have a Stony Brook until 10 years into that period. The fact that we are ranked 65th based upon those data, I think, is absolutely remarkable. Stony Brook's record is particularly impressive when you think about where our students come from, the background. Long Island is usually thought of as being affluent, white, and well-educated. But as Dean Ronald Douglas and Vice Provost Aldona Jonitis have shown us, many of our students come from a very different Long Island than that. More than 25% of our undergraduates are first-generation college students. Many of them are the children of recent immigrants and minorities. In general, our students come from backgrounds where the commitment to educational advancement is much more pronounced than a tradition of intellectual experience. Only 2 out of 5 of our undergraduates have fathers who graduated from college, and 1 out of 5 has a father who never even completed high school. Those data on the limited educational background are not typical of the people who go to public universities in the United States. Stony Brook has the highest percentage and the greatest numbers of minority students, blacks, Hispanics, and Asian Americans. We have the largest percentage and the largest number of any SUNY center in the system. 25% of our undergraduates come from families whose annual income are less than $20,000. Less than $20,000. That percentage is more than double for the U.S. as a whole, and when you consider the cost of living on Long Island, that is remarkable. Now, I'm talking primarily about the undergraduate enterprise at this point, but I want to note briefly the quality of graduate education and research at Stony Brook. We're attracting more and better graduate students than ever before, and they are finding their experience more satisfactory at Stony Brook than ever before. Those who go on to academic careers are offered faculty positions in the finest universities, not only in the United States, but throughout much of the world. We have our graduates on the faculties of Oxford University, all of the Ivy League institutions, and many, many other distinguished public and private universities in the United States. Recent peer reviews of our graduate programs ranked our graduate programs among the best in the nation. Applications to Stony Brook for graduate study have gone up each of the last 2 years at a time when the national total of bachelor's degrees awarded has been declining. Stony Brook is playing a national leadership role in developing new strategies for recruiting and retaining minority students for academic professions. That's a very important role, and Stony Brook has taken the lead. Our ranking as a Type 1 research university is a strong indicator of overall program quality. And research at Stony Brook embraces the full range of scholarly activity, experimentation, research, and creative activity. In talking about the large proportion of Stony Brook research activity that's externally supported, externally sponsored, it's important to use numbers because it's a very impressive story. Stony Brook's total activity has now surpassed $70 million and is projected to reach $75 million this year. According to the National Science Foundation, compiled a few years ago, there was only one other university in the United States that had a rate of increase in sponsored research greater than Stony Brook during the period 1976 to 1983. That's impressive. Let me just show you what that looks like. That shows from 1972 to 1988 what our sponsored research activity has looked like. And my friend Bob Schneider offered me some other data to go along with this. I can superimpose this properly. He was trying to indicate my impact on the institution, and it clearly shows that when I became provost, there was an immediate flattening out of sponsored research. And as soon as I announced that I was stepping down, it took off again at a rate unprecedented. And Bob, I appreciate it. I think I've still had a chance to do something about your merit grade. Now, that's high quality, and that's diversity. And in a period when the costs of going to college are going out of sight, Stony Brook represents a singular opportunity for access to this extraordinary array of academic resources. The total annual cost of tuition and fees at Stony Brook is something close to $1,500. If you were to go to a private institution with comparable programs, comparable quality faculty, it would be more than $12,000 at NYU and more than $13,000, just tuition and fees, mind you, at Columbia. We simply have to have an increase in the level of state support if we're going to retain the quality and diversity of our academic program. And if we're going to retain opportunities for access for those who need it most, those people I described earlier who can't afford to go to private institutions and who can't afford to go off Long Island to other public universities to get those programs. The only sensible way, I think, to do that is to increase state support through a tuition increase. Our undergraduate programs in health sciences are among the incredible bargains that one can have at Stony Brook. Now, we've seen the reality. Let's look at some of the perceptions that people have at Stony Brook. And there, the message is more mixed. This is what some high school guidance counselors had to say about it. These are from the minutes of an admissions committee meeting. Quote, the counselors felt that the main problems were campus environment, proximity, and the dormitories. The selling points of the university were quality of faculty and diversity of program. The date of that meeting was October 1975. Let me read you an excerpt from another letter. We, approximately 40 mathematics and science teachers, have been involved in the integration of advanced research and science, teaching science and mathematics programs for the last three summers. We have heard an impressive array of Stony Brook's finest researchers. There is no question that Stony Brook is an exciting academic environment. However, many of us would be extremely reluctant to recommend Stony Brook to our students. The dormitories and other public buildings are in an incredible state of decay. This decay must certainly pervade the cultural, social, and academic life at Stony Brook. We urge you as provost to devote your greatest efforts to remedy these problems. The date of that meeting, August 1987. Now, we have made significant progress in this university, I think, even since 1987. But we have to remember that the people who judge us from outside, particularly those who have a crucial influence on college choice, they use a scale relative to other institutions, not relative to the problems that we can all recount, and not relative to the unique situation of being on Long Island. They're not interested in our problems. My dad used to tell me there are two things people aren't interested in, your kids and your troubles. Residence halls play a major role in shaping how students feel about Stony Brook. There's no question about that. We have to continue to work to improve them and to improve and expand the range and the quality of residential academic programs in those residence halls. And as I said, there are many encouraging signs. I think many of the arrows are pointing in the right direction, but we have an awful lot to do. Once we get the students, we have to keep them. We have to do a better job of keeping them. That means that we have to improve the quality of our undergraduate teaching, to expand the range of course offerings, the programs, and we have to continue to work to enrich the campus culture. A lot of us in colleges and universities are quick to point to inferior teaching of our colleagues in high schools and elementary schools. We're less eager to look at the quality of our own teaching. Good teaching in a university isn't just standing up in front of a large lecture and being a compelling lecturer. It's much more than that. Good teaching has to pervade everything we do in this university. In September of this year, we're going to open a new faculty instruction support office to assist all of those on our faculty who want to improve their teaching. An international search has resulted in the selection of Dr. Robert Boyce, who will be coming early this summer to head up that important new office. Now, what about the enhancement of campus culture? It has been clearly and unambiguously established that the extent and the diversity of student involvement particularly at the undergraduate level, in campus life, in the intellectual life, in social life, those play a key role in determining how much a student benefits from her college experience and how strongly a student is bonded to his alma mater. So we have to continue to work hard to reweave the social and the intellectual fabric of this campus, to extend the opportunities for student involvement, for engagement, for exploration, opportunities to increase the amount of physical and intellectual energy that our students can invest in their total academic experience. It's interesting that if you read the literature on this, three areas that are shown to have very significant impact are: one, intercollegiate athletics; two, honors programs; and three, participation in faculty research and projects. We have a gifted faculty here. We have them in abundance. Scholars who are pushing back the limits of our fields of knowledge, artists and musicians that stir our hearts and souls and cause our imaginations and our spirits to soar. We have a lot of faculty like that. And one of the areas we've concentrated on in the last couple of years is giving more opportunities to our students to work one-on-one as partners with our faculty. And that was the reason for creating the Eureka program, the Undergraduate Research and Creative Activities program. And this year we had over 400 students participating in that, and the number is increasing. Honors College. The Honors College will open in September, and the new faculty master, Elof Carlson, will head up the Honors College. In September, there will also be a new residential learning center. The Science, Engineering, Mathematics Residential College will open in September, and Professor Joseph Lauer from chemistry will be its director. That was a residence hall, a new program that was started as a partnership between the university and Long Island's high technology industries, and they are providing much needed support for us to rehab that facility and have some new programs. Intercollegiate athletics, what can I tell you? We're just finishing up our first season in Division I lacrosse, having had a very successful season. Our last game is against Jim Lack's alma mater, Pennsylvania, and we're going to beat them, Jim. Students aren't the only ones that need more culture on campus. Our faculty and our staff also, we want to have more culture. We now have a university club, not complete by any means, but it's a good start, and we'll continue to develop that. I think we should continue to pursue the idea of having a Fine Arts Center Plaza Cafe in that little area outside this building where now a number of our faculty park their car. That should be converted into a cafe. And I think we should try to do that within a year. All of these quality enhancements are essential to Stony Brook's ability to enter that top ranks of premier research universities. They really are critical. What about our size, though? Are we preoccupied with growth, with size, at the expense of quality? There are some people who feel that we are. I think we are not. I think it is crucial that we increase our size. Our student-faculty ratio is rich. It is too rich. Not because we have too many faculty, but because we have too few students. We have to continue to increase the size of our student body if we are going to retain the faculty we have, let alone to grow in stature. Our immediate plans call for increasing the number of undergraduates, part-time graduate students, full-time graduate students. So across the waterfront, we intend to increase those enrollments. But we're going to have to concentrate the growth in areas where we can attract and retain excellent students without having to provide full support for them. We simply can't afford it. There's an old fortune cookie saying that there are two ways to increase the fraction of life. You either increase the numerator or you decrease the denominator. And that's true of student-faculty ratio. If we don't increase the numerator, the number of students, you can be sure that somebody else is going to decrease our denominator, the number of faculty that we have. That's what the student-faculty ratio looked like at Stony Brook and in all of the other university centers. Albany, 20-1. Binghamton, 18-1. Buffalo, 20-1. Stony Brook, 15-1. Now, you can say, but that's because the rest of those universities are older, that they've got inexpensive programs, big schools of education, management, business. communication, law, library science, public health, criminal justice, and our friends at Buffalo have the Millard Fillmore School. If we just remove those, we'll be all right. Or will we? That's what happens if you remove all of the cheap programs from the other institutions and you leave Stony Brook alone. 21 to 1, 18 to 1, 19.62 to 1, Stony Brook 14.87, or if you recalculate it as Ray has done for me, it comes up to 15.55. We have a problem that we cannot run away from. If we were going to get Stony Brook to a student-faculty ratio of 16 to 1, we would still have to give up as many as 50 faculty, or we would have to add as many as 900 students. If we wanted to get to 17 to 1, we would have to give up 100 faculty or add as many as 1,750 FTEs. That's a tall order. I want to repeat, our student-faculty ratio is too rich, not because we have too many faculty, but because we have too few students. And to make matters worse, while we have the richest student-faculty ratio in all of SUNY, among SUNY centers, many of our undergraduates complain about the great number of large classes that we have and the large number of classes that are taught by teaching assistants. Those complaints are greater at Stony Brook than they are at the other university centers or in reports from other major research universities. That's what our customers say about it, and it's something that we have to be very sensitive to and continue to work on. The challenge of recruiting more students is going to be compounded by declining numbers of prospective students between now and 1994. Because over the next 5 years, the college-age cohort of traditional high school graduates is going to decline by 18%. So we're swimming upstream. At the time the pool is shrinking, we must increase the size of our student body. Now what about the diversity of our student body? Other aspects of enrollment affect the kind of institution that we have. Over 85% of our students come from Long Island and the New York City metropolitan area. We have more foreign students at Stony Brook than students from all of the other states combined. The dominance of Long Island and New York City students creates an inbred social environment that does not adequately equip students for more diverse future experiences. Have to work on that. The percentage of our students who enter as alternative admit is also still too high. It's over 30%. Those who don't meet the normal admission requirements based on academic criteria, but who still show promise. Over 30%, and if you add EOP, it's over 40%. So if we're going to enrich the educational experience of those who attend this university, we're going to have to attract better students, and we're going to have to do it from a broader geographical area in greater numbers than we do. An increase in the number of out-of-state students, or even students from off Long Island, would have a dramatic effect on the culture of the campus. It would require us to create a 7-day-a-week campus instead of the 5-day-a-week or 4.5-day-a-week campus that has characterized us for too long. Now, what about size and graduate support? At the graduate level, we not only have too few students overall, but we have too few inexpensive graduate students. Students who are enrolled in disciplines where it has not been necessary to provide full support to attract and retain high-quality students. We need to find additional sources of support for our students who are funded. We continue to fund too high a percentage of our graduate students on TA and GA lines, which are created, as you well know, by breaking up faculty and staff lines. 88%, nearly 90% of our full-time graduate students are supported in whole or in part, and out of that, 68% are supported with state resources, much too high. We support a greater percentage of our students on state funds, smaller percentage on trainees, traineeships, fellowships, and grants and contracts than the national norm. And if you look at how that is broken down,
by different parts of the university.
This is what it looks like. And there are obviously some areas where we can and must do much better. These are the total full-time graduate students. The percentage is the students, full-time students who are supported, those supported by the state, the percentage, and the percentage supported by grants, contracts, and fellowships. And I don't think it requires any comment. It's clear where the areas, I think, where opportunity are. The imbalance in funding of our graduate students has other implications. Because if you look at the percentage of our graduate students who are foreign students, it has increased by 27% between 1976 and 1988. So we're having an increase in our foreign graduate students, most of whom are supported on TAs and GAs, most of whom end up in a classroom, and that causes problems, in some cases, in the quality of instruction. That will also be something that the FISO office, the Faculty Instruction Support Office, will take on, because they will have a major role in providing workshops and training for TAs. The amount of growth that we need to have is not trivial. The university core campus full-time graduate enrollment is planned to increase by nearly 30% over the next 5 years, 28% over the next 5 years. It means we're also going to have to expand the amount of graduate student support that we have out of grants and contracts and fellowships. We have done a better job than that over the last 5 years. The percentage of students that we support out of grants and contracts has increased by about a third, 33%. Tuition poses a problem for our graduate students, as you know, because the tuition money that we get from the state is keyed only to those students who are on state-supported TAs and GAs, and the students who are supported off grants and contracts don't enter into that. That is a problem that looms on the horizon for next year at a level of at least $1 million shortfall. Part-time learners, we also want to have a large increase, about 30% over the next 5 years. That's what we're planning on. Big increase. Our School of Continuing Education is playing a major role there. Not as an ornamental activity hanging off on one side, but as an integral component of the university. It is a terribly important part of this university. The increased demand for part-time learners will continue to go up. George Keller has commented that by the year 1990, half of all college students across this country will be part-time learners. We're fairly well positioned, I think, to exploit that with new certificate programs that are now online for next fall. With a new MPS, Master of Professional Studies, new MAT, Master of Arts in Teaching, the Lifelong Learning Society that was created by our friends in the back, Senators Lack and Laval, the Center for Corporate Education. All of these are exceedingly important activities if we're going to increase the number in the numerator, our number of students, so that we can protect the denominator. We're also going to have growth on the research side in terms of grants and contracts. In spite of that impressive record, and it is impressive, we have a long way to go. If you compare our record with those of our peer institutions, it's apparent that there is a great deal of unrealized potential with the present faculty for increased sponsored research. A cursory examination of NSF and NIH summer reports indicates that the average funding per funded faculty member at Stony Brook relative to our peers is low by a factor of 2 to 3. And in many cases, it's in areas where today there's enormous potential for getting sponsored research money. Let me just show you what those data look like. The funding per faculty member, all faculty members, non-health, 44,000, and health, 36. Now, if you look at it on the basis of per funded faculty member, it goes to 115,000 in the non-health area, and to 98,000 in the health area. There's still a lot of room in both of these. We're low by a factor of 2 to 3, particularly in certain of our disciplines, in engineering, in some of the sciences, and in the biomedical sciences. Also in the clinical sciences, there's a lot of room for growth. We'll
We're going to have to have that if we're going to be able to sustain the growth of the student body here at Stony Brook. Let me turn now to centers and instances. The initiatives of individual faculty will continue to be the central focus of the research enterprise at Stony Brook. But we now have new centers of interdisciplinary and multidisciplinary strength. And they are going to be able to help us expand and enrich the graduate and research effort. For the first time in our history, we have a rich, diverse array of scholarly institutes and centers, large and small, basic and applied, units that link every department, every division, every corner of this great university together. And they are not a substitute for individual, disciplinary, departmental research. They are a complement to it. All of our new institutes and centers transcend departments. It's increasingly apparent that the search for new knowledge requires new combinations and recombinations of academic competence. Most of the pressing problems faced by society are going to be resolved only by multidisciplinary teams. And this is also true of most of the areas of exciting basic research, regardless of discipline. It's a different world. Roland Schmidt, president of RPI, observed, quote, "Discipline-based, simply connected organizational chart for a campus cannot possibly match the opportunities and complexity of multiply connected sources of inspiration." I think he's right. We now have institutes and centers that offer those multiple connections. They also have another benefit. They are going to provide us with a shelter for faculty while we address that more pervasive problem of our student-faculty ratio. Because by having faculty housed in our institutes and centers, they are in the organized research function, and therefore they do not enter those calculations. And it buys us some time that we desperately need to address that student-faculty ratio. Now, let's turn to the region and the university's role in serving the region. Last year, I pointed out to you that our location on Long Island is an obstacle, but that it's also an opportunity. They really come as a matched set on Long Island. Being here is an enormous obstacle, but it's a large and growing opportunity. Because we're on Long Island, the cost of living is enormous. One of the highest costs of living anywhere in the United States. Cost of housing, taxes, water, garbage, and electricity. If they're not at the top in the nation, they're near the top. Long Island is a fragile environment with a sole source aquifer and hundreds, indeed thousands of miles of sensitive shoreline, coastal environment, and freshwater surface waters that need to be protected. Long Island doesn't have any regional focus, no major city, no concentrated political power base, poor public transportation. All of these are problems, but we are not without our opportunities. Indeed, I think our opportunities on Long Island are enormous. We live in a beautiful area, one with a good climate, almost no unemployment, although that's changing a little bit. And we live in an area with an enormous population. A few years ago, Rand McNally ranked Long Island as the best place in the United States to live. More recently, Money Magazine ranked us sixth best place in the United States to live. And it is a good place to live. It's good for people who've lived here for a decade. It's good for people who come into the university or corporations at senior levels with good salaries. It's good for undergraduates who live on campus in residence halls or live at home. But it is not a very good place for graduate students who have to live in the community. And it is not a very good place for young staff and faculty members who have to find housing away from the university. And we're going to have to do a lot more to help with that. As I mentioned, we have an enormous population. More than 7 million people. That's all of Long Island, including Brooklyn and Queens. On Long Island, we've got more than 40% of the state's total population. If we were a state, we would be the 10th most populous state in the nation. Only California, Texas, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Florida, Ohio, the rest of New York, Michigan, and New Jersey would have greater populations than we have on Long Island. Now, think of those states. Think of their public universities. And think of the tuitions and fees those public universities charge. On Long Island, we have a population 50% greater than the entire population of the state of Wisconsin. Think of the University of Wisconsin at Madison. We've got a population 25% greater than